So when they, you know, asked me, you know, where to, you got it and all that, I had about 15 minutes or probably half an hour in the very beginning, unharassed, to cook up a story, even though in the very beginning I really panicked. But I would say after 5-10 minutes I kind of recollected myself and managed to come up with the story and stick to it. And no one really pressured me to tell the full story, except Sarhang Shashani in the original place, which he was not supposed to do at all. In those days, they really, once they found out that you're not Tudeyi, they did not kind of pursue questioning. There was no torture. They used to beat you up, they whip you a few times, but it wasn't really a sin, because if they wanted to, they would have easily been able to make me say where I got it. I was 18 years old. Easily kind of there, but they didn't. So I went to Farmund Nizami and I was there for 3 days. From there they sent me to Zindan Qasr. They said, what they said was that you stay here until you say where you got this. They actually went after this guy, and he was from Hamadan. They went all the way to Hamadan. They could not locate this guy. But he found out about it when he applied for exit visa to leave the country. He came to know the story years later, but at the time, and they dropped the story. Obviously, they did not pursue it diligently. They pursued it for a while, and the only reason they didn't pursue it is within days after my arrest, they had already captured the house where the print machine was located and the rest of their stuff, and it was not really a big deal for them. Perhaps if they had no other lead, they were sensitive about publication of this thing outside, but they had managed to get to the source in other ways. I know that other people were arrested with this, and not with 150, but 5, 10, or 1. They didn't really bother. Here, later I learned, Marjo, he told me that literally 3 or 4 days after my arrest, they discovered the place. My father contacted, my father was very close friend with Harizadeh, who was very close to Zahidi, and he was Vakil Avval Tehran. And Harizadeh had called a chief of the Bakhtiari, you know, family. He did not know Taimur Bakhtiar himself. He called another Bakhtiar who was a senator at the time. Anyway, I could remember. So my father went to see him, and he sent my father to Bakhtiar, and Bakhtiar told him, well, yes, I can let him go as soon as he says where he got these, you know, pamphlets and all that. And so I went to the Zindan, and here, once I went to Zindan, not Sharbani, but not the building of Hukumat Nizami, but the temporary facilities of Sharbani. There, we were put with other prisoners, with political prisoners. One person I knew, another teacher I had, and I saw him there, he was my physics teacher, was Behazin Etemazen. I remember the first thing when I saw him in that prison, I started smoking a cigarette. He came to me and directly said, why are you smoking a cigarette? And he was the source of, he has one arm missing. So he was very, he was a chappy, even though he knew me from the activities of school, Dabiristan, Behbani, but the fourth year when I was there, and then transferred at the end of the year to Iran Shah. So I got to know there were gangs of organization. They're largely Tudeyi. They were very organized, they were very together, and they influenced others. So when I went in, even in prison, I found a few other pan-Iranist, pro-Mossadegh of eclectic characters who we organized. I was there for about a week. And then they transferred me to Qasr prison. Again, I remember getting onto, there was one woman who I have always remembered, her face. When we got into this truck to be transferred, you know, to Qasr, she turned to, I think, virtually everyone in that car. There were probably 20, 25 people. The trucks that had chairs around and the people who couldn't find a seat would stand up. And there was this woman, there were two women in the car, you know, one of them, extremely articulate and very beautiful. Also. She turned to the people who were there, condemning the two days who signed Tobiname. I said, when you go to prison, tell the Rufaqa that they are producing shame. She actually gave a lecture that I was genuinely moved by the spirit and the strength of this woman. I have no idea, I never learned who she was. And when we were there, so we were separated, and still under 18, I was put into Bandido, which was for teenagers. Up to 18, there was a teenager. So I went inside the huge prison camp. They were all fundamentally one group of Tudeyi, one scattered group of Mosaddiqis, and, you know, criminal, you know, elements and all that. I was there for another 8 days. Again, getting involved in heavy discussion with Tudeyis, continuing the fundamentally maintaining a reasonable, you know, spirit, and at the same time learning a great deal about the Iranian society, that the kind of people who were in prison and all that. Because, you know, when you're raised in a middle class family, you could be completely. Another very important thing that really relates to all this is that there was another man who was very active on behalf of Mossadegh. It was Imullah, Sheikh Baqir Nahavandi. In those days, it wasn't so much an idea with whom you identify ideologically, but who is doing something. And if you were a doer, if, you know, a caring Dashti, you look for action, you look for doers. So Nahavandi, obviously. And remember that in those days, it has so much to do with the whole, what, you know, happened later, that the religious elements had a very positive and a pleasant image in our minds, you know, the ones who stayed with Mossadegh, you know. And Nahavandi was a pro-Mossadegh. And another night, 86 people were arrested in Nahavandi. So it was a meeting or a jalase, tafsir, interpretation of Nahjul Balagha. It was the title for. So a lot of kids, university students, usually pro-Mossadegh people from the neighborhood. So we went there, and the two trucks of soldiers came and arrested, you know, everybody. So this was the second time, but this time they didn't even ask our names. You know, fortunately, there was a pharmacist who saw the situation, and he was our neighbor. So he informed my family. So we were there for less than 48 hours, and after 48 hours, they kept Nahavandi, and they kicked the rest of us. And it was not prison; it was Lashkar-e-Doe Zerehi, that it was a place also for soldiers that the river, all, you know, kept them. Anyway, so I had one solid record and one imprisonment without any, you know, record or even, you know, identification. So when I finished high school, during high school, this was the period that going to the United States, going abroad, was the in thing. I don't know of any kid who hadn't thought about it. Some took it more seriously than others. So that, yeah, I really wanted to go abroad. By this time, I had learned that if I'm interested in studying, again, the politics, huquq, we used to call it in those days, I should go to an environment where such, you know, study is possible, because I got to know many people, and I continued with Maliki, was freed. I used to see him very regularly, and he used to relate to me more as a teacher. He was a very impressive man. He had his, like the rest of us, he had his flaws, but as an intellectual, he was quite impressive and learned, you know. And a Turk, you know. So I was, later on, it was through his influence. So when I finished high school, we either had to have maafi, or we had to serve in order to be able to leave the country, to get an exit visa. So I decided to sign up for, and every year, the number of people who actually are wanted for reserve service, for military service from high school graduate, was really much smaller than the number who had volunteered. But unfortunately, that particular year, there were about 4,000 high school and university students who had signed up, and they needed about 900, and there were 600 volunteers. So we all went to Saltanat Abad one day for Qura Kashi, for lottery to get the other 300, and I was one of the 300. And again, that was not really, that was again out of dumbness, because they told us that whether you pick your lottery first or last, it doesn't make any difference. We have, 3,100 pooch, and 300 sarbaz, which is, and in fact, I managed to influence somebody to go to the front of the line. I was way in the back. We said, well, let's get it over with and go on. But the reality was that they didn't really have time to wait for all of them. So they put lots of soldiers in the beginning. So within the next 2 or 3 hours of the day, they got enough, 300, and they told the rest of the people to go home. You're all ma'afsa. So I was drafted. And later, I desperately tried for about 3 weeks through my father, who knew a general who was also a physician, Timsar Kani, who was an eye specialist. So I went in, my father tried to influence him to say that I'm physically handicapped. He looked at me, he said, not at all, you're... But in the meantime, after 3 weeks, I really liked the experience. So when my father tried to see someone else, I said, stop it, because I'm really enjoying it. It was a fascinating experience of military service. I wish it was required for everybody.
what did you like?
In the sense that first, for the very first time, I saw a cross-section of Iranian youth. And there were 45 or 47 of us in artillery unit. The chief of our artillery, who was also someone, Khashayar Mustafabi, he was an engineer. He was also a champion of he was a chess champion. I don't know if you... Anyway, I got to know him, and I was very interested in him, some other friends. Just the experience of living with some people and going through this physical exercise, going to class, living a very disciplined and regimented life and all that, doing your own work. The whole experience appealed to me. That unlike the images I had before I went in, I realized this is really, it's interesting, it's fun. It was different.
Where were you stationed now?
At the 9 months we were in Saltanat Abad. So we went to school for 9 months to get basic training, and also I went through training as a reserve officer. After the 9 months I was sent to Gurgaon. And in fact, I wanted to go there. My average was not high enough to stay in Tehran, where I wanted to, because mathematics were very important, and I was poor in mathematics. But I was close enough to kind of choose as the second choice. So if I couldn't stay in Tehran, I went to Gurgaon, because I had a khale there, and I was very close to her. We used to be very, very close. So I went to Gurgaon, because everything was, when I went to Gurgaon to go there, theoretically my position was a third lieutenant in the Gurdan, in the artillery unit. What I became very interested in there was teaching Farsi. And again, there in our Gurdan, it was an incredible discovery to me that more than half of the soldiers could not even speak Farsi. I mean, they were... They were Turkmens, Turks, Lor, from all over the country, and we had was the Guru Vans, they were also, they were often translators. And the reserve officers, our job, one function we had besides the regular duty we were supposed to play as a trainee of whatever it was we were trained for, was teaching kindergarten, except that I took this very seriously. And the other one was kind of irrelevant. I mean, it was, we never practiced. Not, it was just a sham, really.
Did you do any political work?
No. During this period, there was no political. The only political thing I would say that I got involved in, it didn't really cause any difficulty, but toward the end of my almost finished at the end, there was a coup in Iraq, the 58 coup against the monarchy, you know. And then apparently there was this order for Rokhendo in every Lashkar to do an investigation, to ask people and produce a report. So they were routinely asking all officers, what do you think about this coup? You know, do you know anything about it? And I happened to know, because I used to follow it and I had done reading, you know. So I had, for whatever they were, so when he asked me, I gave a lecture. We talked extensively, you know, and all. So he had reported that this guy seems to know, you know, quite a bit about Nasser and nationalist movement in the Arab world, you know, and all. Because during this period, Nasser was our hero, and we used to read anything we could get our hands on about him. So I was questioned by the next, there was a colonel who was the assistant to the deputy commander. He called me in and asked me some more questions, and he realized that I was just a reserve officer and simply interested. That was only, there was no political, but the major work I did there was that I still have very fond memories, was teaching reading and writing to soldiers. The most touching thing was at the end, they got a gift for me and there was a big celebration and all that. For a departing kind of, you know, party that soldiers and the Guru Bans had organized. So after that I came to Tehran.
And about a year, you
said? In 9 months. Altogether 9 months. We were a year and a half. The reserve officers had a year and a half. 9 months by training and... So when I went to Tehran, immediately applied for visa, exit. First getting the records in and acceptance. I had a friend in California who had already sent me an acceptance from the college. When I applied for exit visa, you had to do it through the Ministry of Education. And you go in and your name is there, they say you've been cleared. So I waited and waited, and finally I went in one day and they said, well, you have to introduce yourself to by this time, you know, Sazman Amniyat was established and they were looking into these records. So my file from the prison, the record. You know. So I mean, it took me altogether almost a year. You know, but six, 7 months of going back and forth for just very stupid kind of reasons. Nothing, you know, they knew exactly what it was and all that. Just you go in and say they will come back in 3 weeks, come back in 2 weeks. The usual bureaucracy, right? And it was also a period that it was difficult to party bazi. I don't know why. I don't know if my family couldn't manage to get. We approached a number of people and they refused to deal with this, to recommend anybody for kind of clemency or for influence to this particular organization. Later on, I learned that my case was not an exception of one, but was not an isolated one. And for a while, you know, it was an organization that generally people were hesitant to, because they didn't know, you know, here is a kid, he might do something awful and I'd be in trouble. So my father couldn't. Usually he had all kinds of contact to manage these difficulties like the rest of you. But here they couldn't. So finally they said, fine, go. And there was one man who said, okay, I'll let you go if you write a statement saying that you repent and you're loyal and all that. And also, when you go abroad, if you see anybody involved in political activity against the Iranian government, you must report. And he gave me a name and an address, which was in Khiabun Amiriye. It was the address of Khayati. So Khayati Fulan, Aghay Fulan. I assume that it was Ismail Mostar. You write to me and you commit yourself to this. I said, sure. I signed everything. But the purpose was to get out and all that. I signed everything, you know. Then I came to California. But it didn't take me very long after I came here to be involved in in political. I went directly to Sacramento. In fact, I arrived in New York on April 24th, 1959. You know, and I had a very dumb friend in California who told me that if you really want to see the United States, don't take the plane. I took the train from Tehran to Tabriz, spent some time with some family friends in Tabriz. From there, I took the bus to Erzurum. From there, I took the train to Istanbul. I did this intentionally. I wanted to stay, and I mean, every place I... And then from there to Yugoslavia. And then Yugoslavia, because again, that was another romantic image through Maliki and Mirusevo. We had this romantic view of Yugoslavia. When you grow up later and think about these things, they are really very funny how these images are formed. Yugoslavia was a kind of mad, you know, the utopia I had done. And from there to Germany, I spent some time in Germany, a few days in each place. From there, I took the ship, the United States line, which was again my choice. That also idea, I'd also dreamed about the idea of going across the Atlantic on a ship, on a boat. I don't know where I got that. I think probably reading translation of Hemingway or Faulkner. I used to read these people. Anything translated, I used to read it just voraciously. So they had a lot about sailing and all that. I remember. To New York, and here I was planning to take a plane to California. He said, no, take the bus.
How long did it take?
3 days, 70-some hours. It was the most miserable trip, the most miserable trip. And I did see it was all from one bus station to another. So I went to California, studied some language and all that, and then worked. When I got to California, I had $30.
That's all.
I had $30 in my pocket. That was all left. And I was very determined not to get any money from...
Didn't get government
help at that time? No, there was none. You had to take examination and all that, but I didn't go. I came, the vast majority of the students came on their own. Some worked and some received assistance from that. So if I had a friend who was working in Sacramento as a dishwasher, who is now a very successful businessman in Los Angeles, he went back later on to Iran and worked with Lajavadi after he'd finished his education here, and now he's back. He was working as a dishwasher, and I became his assistant. The third day I arrived there, I was his assistant. I worked there for a while, and I worked as, I learned the game of, here, in this country, in that sense, it's really an incredible place to, if you're willing to support. So that was the beginning, and then I traveled to Los Angeles area. I bought a car later on. I traveled, I went to Santa Barbara. I loved that city. I fell in love with the city. So I went to the college there and got my acceptance. And the following spring term, I started my college in Santa Barbara.
And you started studying what?
Politics and literature. Literature was for my own love. Any course, I had one teacher who taught Shakespeare. I was very interested in him. But that was my own interest. But also studying. Then I studied there for 2 years and then got a scholarship to go to University of Arizona. And then from then on, just again, completed my work there, then got another Ford Foundation Fellowship to go to Claremont Graduate School for my PhD. But in the meantime, during this period, I was very active in the student movement. As soon as I moved to Santa Barbara, it's interesting that I was still in Sacramento, that Majid was Iranian consulate in San Francisco. I met him twice. The first time he came to there was one Iranian student who was in trouble, and people advised him to pretend that he is crazy and out of his mind. And he was stupid enough, or perhaps crazy enough, to do it. And then the students who were concerned about these things got together and selected two people to take him to the consulate and seek help. And I went along. So we took this man to Majid's office. And he was extremely generous and kind. So he immediately called the hospital. And we went there with another friend. They actually changed. We were there when they sent him inside. So later on, I had another conversation with Majid on the phone, and I told him that, some people say that this thing is all fake, but I tell you that anybody who actually changed his clothes in the insane asylum and went inside is by definition crazy. that is evidence. We don't need to pay attention, and I wanted to encourage him to pursue this. That he was very helpful. And another time he came actually to Sacramento when I was still there to talk to a group of students, and I got up and asked him a couple of pointed political questions that he was very sympathetic to, but he didn't answer. At the end he called me and said, these questions you're raising, they could cause you some danger. So that's how I got to know Majid. It was the beginning of our... Then I continued. Then we organized in Southern California. And the organization in those days, it's really important for the student movement abroad. In those days, student activities abroad were still... the domain of Tudeyi and Mossadeghi. Once again, the Tudeyi is more or less better organized, even though numerically smaller, but Mossadeghi is very anarchistic, but not as intense and so forth. So Shaheen Fatemi was here. I made contact. I wrote him once, and he wrote back, and I invited him to Santa Barbara. And a number of friends in Los Angeles area, we formed the Iranian Student Association with the Iran Name that they were publishing it here. Nakhshab, the same person, Mahmad Nakhshab, who I knew from Iran, he was working for the UN here. He died before the revolution here. He was working for the UN. Another person I knew from there who had come here was Mostafa Chamran, who was at UC Berkeley, and a number of other people from those days reappeared in the States, in California, some, and others that we got to know each other here. And we published a magazine in Southern California called Moj, and I was the editor of the paper. We published 5 issues and we went bankrupt. It ended. Basically, here we were divided. Half of our activities had to do with Iran and half of it with the Tudeh. It was a double kind of confrontation. Just as in the past, that they used to get, let's form a unified organization, and we had rejected categorically and say you are agents of foreign power and we cannot cooperate with you. And until the activities of early 60s, you know, when I left Iran, the political scene was dead, the opposition political scene. But in Los Angeles, when we were here, and we were inspired by what was happening in Iran. When the Shah came 64, I participated in a demonstration. Then after that, they refused to renew my passport, consulate in San Francisco, and so forth. So I didn't have my Iranian passport for about 4 years. And the fifth year, they gave it to me, and I don't know why they didn't and why they did.
How could you get a visa when you didn't have a passport?
I was already at this time married to an American woman in Santa Barbara. So I didn't really need the passport, but nevertheless, I kept writing to them and asking them, not for any need. Later on, I became, you know, naturalized, actually, because I needed the passport. It was more a combination of gradually feeling that we were really part of the American scene. I had my sons were born, and even though by that time I had separated from my first wife and all that, but with the children here and all that, and the issue of custody came in, I actually got the custody of my children. My lawyer said it's important that you establish, but it was, you know, a cluster of reasons. So I became, you know, naturalized. Later, I got my passport. And when I went to Iran, nobody said anything at all. Beginning in 69, I went to Iran every other year until the revolution. Altogether, I think I went to Iran about 7 times.
And you had no problem?
Absolutely no problem. Absolutely not. Absolutely. We were extremely open, and everything I wrote, it was with my own name, you know, and all. And we were cautious in the sense that we were active in the early, I would say, up to about 1964. One could say that what we were doing was not illegal. There were all the people among us, and even people like, you know, Nakhshab and Fatimi and all that. They didn't really want to completely disconnect from Iran, and we did not want to disconnect. It wasn't the case that we were completely rejecting. I give you a very good example of the nature of the activities we had. When Zahedi refused to renew Shaheen's and Sadiq Qutbzadeh's visas, we actually tried to mediate. To the extent that Zahedi was open to this mediation, and he invited 2 members of the Iranian Student Association in California, Hassan Libasci and Dr. Mesfahpour, he was a pharmacist who is in Iran. He invited them to Washington, you know, and treated them and dinner and all that. So they were, you know, activist people. And fundamentally, when they returned, they said something to me that suddenly it was a shocking. In terms of my perception of Zahedi, when they said Zahedi, said, you know, Shaheen Fatimi, I don't really want to bother him now. Later on, when he goes to Iran and becomes a minister, then I meet him barash bezanam. I asked Hassan, did he really say that? He said yes. You know, he said he wanted to say that we didn't really had no intention of. They made a big deal out of it. And it was not our intention of not renewing the visa, and he wanted to say that it was below his dignity to deny them visa at this time. Later on, when they're... So the nature of the activities up to that time were not confrontational and revolutionary in the sense that you become, you know, outlaws. It was more or less the same, even in the Nehzat-e-Muhammad, in the immediate activities of post... the coup period, the first few years. Anyway, well, that's a different, you know, as time went on, as time went on, particularly from 64 on, these two groups of activists, the Tudeh and Mossadeghi, they gradually diminished. They either lost interest, or they finished their work and returned to Iran, or completely changed their perspectives and became apolitical and so on. I would say by late 60s, these two groups, who were really the backbone, the totality of the student activity, both in the States and in Europe, we also were in close contact with Europe. As an editor and writer in Europe in those days, Amir Pishtad and Hossein Malek, these people were publishing Name Parsi, and Ali Shariati was there, except I knew him by name, I had not met him there. But a number of people associated with Maliki, Dadashpur, they were publishing this paper, so I was in contact with these people. I wrote for them. Once Bani Sad came later on, and he published his Iran Name. So we all sat down. But I want to say that gradually, I would say between the early 60s, right after Amini, which I always thought Amini was, with the firing of Amini, Shah actually abolished the institution of premiership in Iran. Up to that time, the premiership had some independent authority and leeway. Anyway, from then on, these two groups kind of diminished, and new political activists were coming on the scene, and their number was increasing, and this is also the period that the number of Iranian students coming to the United States is dramatically increasing, that people of my political orientation, as well as people of Tudeh political orientation, who were also a scatterer, they felt isolated, outsiders. Now, Sheikhai Fadai Khal are on the scene. Tut Mujahideen were never active abroad. The Iranian Muslim Association, gradually the late 60s active. And suddenly we see a new generation of Iranian students.
More radical, would you say?
No, but in one sense more radical, in another sense, in a cultural sense, for example, some of the students, Muslim Student Association, they're extremely conservative. So they congregate amongst themselves. They become very much concerned with eating habits, religious rituals, and so forth. And yet they were not really political. They were political only symbolically. About less than a year before the revolution, Yazdi came to Davis to give a lecture, and in the lecture that it was very political and I would say militant, he did not mention Shah's name. The closest he came to was I don't remember, something symbolic like Shemr or Yazid or something like that. He used something symbolic that the audience knew what he was talking about, but not directly. The Muslim Student Association remained political very symbolically toward, until I would say mid-77, late 77, and for the vast majority of them, as individuals, the vast majority of them, with the beginning of demonstrations.
But prior to that, when you say they were political, you mean it was cultural mostly?
It was, right, religious. So they have mostly get together, they read the literature from Shariati's writings, Bazargan's writings, are distributed widely. They have discussion sessions. They pay a great deal of attention to their mosques, where they go to praying, to fasting. Days of important religious rituals, for example, it's Ashura, it's the birth of Muhammad, and all that. They have established an organization, and they get together, they associate with one another, and so forth. And there's a close sense of cultural identity And yet not in an overtly political way, the way, for example, the Cherry Cover, you know, they were very militant and radical. Into the, or the way the remnants of the younger people of the National Front orientation, who had become some of them more Marxist than the real, you know, Marxists in ideological rhetoric. It was the only way they could compete with others. So the politics became not only radicalization was not really a reason enough for isolation and detachment, but the fact that all their reference came from outside Iran. It was China, okay. It was Albania, it was Cuba, it was, you know, Che Guevara. The models of analysis or the models of political movement, which was South Yemen, depending on what was fashionable or not, that, and they were totally ignorant about either the Mossadegh period, just as our generation, we were totally ignorant about the Constitutional Revolution and the period immediately following. Simply because I became a student, a bit interested as a person, I studied, but as a group, there were very few of us who studied politics, so in school I was interested. But as a group, we were extremely ignorant, I mean really ignorant, about the Iranian history in general and the recent history, which was so much connected to Mossadegh in particular. This discontinuity reappeared and re-emerged with the new generation of activists, that every time, for them, if we talked about the Mossadegh period as a significant event in forming political consciousness or influencing the history of our country, they dismissed it categorically. Iran and its future could be understood according to a theoretical construct. The Red Book of Mao and the rest. And it was a disease, to the extent that communication with many of these people became impossible. And yet, as a teacher, by this time, you know, I started teaching in 1969. So I taught in Southern California and then went north. So I meet a lot of students. So when I talk to them individually, I see them being very uninformed and shallow. But in group, they are very militant and intransigent and harsh and all that. So, which is another face of the same disease, that this so-called sense of solidarity was not something which was existentially felt, but the behavior pattern which defined their belonging or their attachment to a group. As soon as there was a threat, they disintegrated, you know. They went after accumulation of capital instead of, you know. Many of them became very successful in real estate business in Northern California. Anyway, it's fascinating, at least for people of my generation, my book, gradually we had an easier time to communicate with Muslim Student Association than with the leftists, simply because they were more civilized in their personal behavior, they were more polite. Second, their model and their standards of judgment were Iran. The nativity in the language, in their concerns, in the theorization and so forth was appealing. And also there was graded degree of continuity between the new generation of activist Muslim students and their older and the older predecessors. For example, people like Yazdi, Mustafa Chamran, Mehmet Nakhshab, Abul Hassan Banisad, they had humane relationship. They had cordial humane relationship. Even they could socially relate to each other. For us, it was, you know, on the political level, it was much easier to relate to them, but we could never be social friends, you know. because their lifestyle was very different, even though politically you, in politics, you work with what is, you know. And these were the ingredients of the political scene, either the Muslim students or the variety of leftists who really were childish with some lunatic elements. The vast majority of them were very sincere and human and intelligent as students, as individuals, but as participants in this movement, they invariably took leave of their own judgment. You know, the examples were numerous. So toward, I would say, in the 70s, they continued, but I maintained more or less active during this entire period for the obvious reason that I was interested. Second, I used to come to Iran regularly and contact old friends, read regularly, and also being on campus all the time, you know, when you're a teacher, you live your life, you're in contact, you know, being on campus and teaching politics, international relations, and so on. So I maintained my contact and interest in all that. I was pretty close to the Iranian student association, Iranian Muslim student, you know, association. They used to invite me, knowing that, you know, they are not, I don't share, and invariably every time there is an opportunity, I tell them that. And what is interesting here is that because of the experience of our generation during the Mossadegh period, that this diversity was normal. Okay. You know, that as a kid I used to go to Ayatollah or Sheikh Baghir. He hated the word Sheikh. He wanted to be called Ayatollah. To Sheikh Ayatollah Nahavandi, or later on, we used to go to Masjid Hidayat, where Taleghani spoke in the years following the coup. We had come to perceive the coexistence and cooperation of religious and secular opponents of the regime as something completely natural. And unthreatening. And also, given the fact that many of us were politicized and socialized during a period that Iran was genuinely was enjoying an open political environment, we had also